I think it's always interesting to look at data, but I think there are several issues that I think could help you focus on your research questions a little bit better. It seems to me you're asking questions about restatements and the impacts of restatements. I think there's two things with your sample that confound that a little bit that I find somewhat troublesome. I don't understand why you include as an event date dates in which there were concerns related to accounting that preceded the restatement. That market reaction, to me, talks about concerns about accounting, not about the effect of having a restatement. And so I don't know whether that ought to be included in the sample if what you're primarily concentrating on is restatement effects. Second of all, when there are restatements that are stealth restatements within 10Ks or 10Qs, there's much more information that's being communicated to the market about the economics of the company through the other information in those Ks and Qs. So I think you're going to have a problem attributing that market reaction to just the restatement. And you might want to cut your sample at least to see what happens if you drop those. I concur with everyone in this analysis that the context of the nature of the restatements are going to be very important to opening up this black box and understanding what we're seeing in the data. So the types of restatements and whether they vary in pre- and post-periods I think are very important. Statistics about the magnitudes of the adjustments to earnings or stockholders' equity before and after and whether that changes. I think a correlation of the magnitude of the stock price to the magnitude of the earnings reported in those restatements or the shift is very important to try to say and tease out whether the reaction is to the restatement adjustment itself and the implications that a revised earnings might have for your belief about the future prospects of the company, from saying a restatement could be problematic because it indicates that the quality of management's controls or the quality of management itself and its system are something different. So I don't know that there's a problem if you don't find a correlation, but it might tell you something differently about what that reaction is to. What surprised me more than anything is in that post period, I don't see separated out the restatements that were driven by PCAOB inspections. It's very possible that I would think that would be of interest to you, and I also think it's possible that if what those restatements are 200 companies having to do something with leases, I don't think that's the number, but there was a lease problem early on, that the market reaction to having 200 companies having to adjust for a lease change is not going to imply much about the management itself. That was a flaw in the system. And it might not say anything about real material errors, and you might get a different sort of reaction to those sorts of restatements that only exist in the post period than they do in the pre period. I think teasing that out would be very interesting. Finally, You do want to say something about variability. And I don't think this is the most powerful way to look at variability. One way, or confidence. You might want to be, Zovana said there might be some belief as to whether there's confidence. I don't think you can get investor confidence, but you might be able to want to tease out whether they're in the post period greater or less disagreement about what earnings means to investors. And the way that one metric that you can look at to try to see whether or not there is disagreements or lack of similarity in beliefs about what they mean is look at trading volume around earnings announcements in the post periods and see if they change differently. That's a better way to be able to tease out disagreement or investors all thinking the same way to the same piece of information.
Lynn Turner?
I think as the academics have pointed around the table, you got your work cut out for you, because I think it is very difficult. My experience is we went through the restatements of Glass-Lewis. It was very, very difficult to figure out why or what drove people's reaction in the marketplace to restatements. For example, you did have 250 to 300 leasing restatements, and almost from the get-go, since when you talked to analysts about it, they concluded that since everyone was doing it, and you compare on a peer-to-peer type basis, it was a thing of a nature that most PMs and analysts really don't understand all that well. It was just let it go unless there was some surprise in it with respect to information on the leases that were going to hit the cash flows in the future. So when we talked to them on that, just universally, they turned around and gave them a pass regardless of how big or small it was. On some of the option backdating, and you said this doesn't cover it, I know on RIM came out and announced a restatement, and their stock shot up exponentially. And the reason it did, notwithstanding a serious option backdating problem, was because at the same time they announced the restatement, they also announced a really good quarter for BlackBerry and that things were looking really up. And what we found with the restatements was with increasing incidences, when companies would announce a restatement, they also put it in with other information that was very positive. So people were packaging a very positive piece of information with what was otherwise negative, and it was not unusual to see stock go jump up. On the other hand, if you had a restatement and it looked like the CEO was going to go, that was those that would tend to go the other way. But the packaging, and it just seemed like more and more often we saw it where people were picking up a good piece of news and going with it. On that basis, the restatements on cash flows, of which there's a whole group in here, since it didn't change anything on the overall cash flow of the company, the typical analyst didn't care. As strange as that may seem, because even if it moved it from operating down into a financing or vice versa, just in general, because it was still on the same financial statement and just a matter of which line you went to, even though that was probably very significant in terms of was this something that was really recurring as operating or not, they tended to just ignore those. The other thing, and I think Vinny actually picked up something very good here to go back and look. If you look at the category, well, better lucky than right, huh, Vin? You know? So, that's my partner, former partner. Okay. But anyway, if you look at the restatements, pre-SOX, we really didn't have the things as much like cash flow. You certainly didn't have the derivative stuff, which the analysts have never understood. We had a lot more pre-SOX in terms of the percentage of these that were revenue recognition, no question about it. Post-SOX, the revenue recognition ones have dropped significantly as a percentage of the whole thing. I mean, big time. And so the ones like that, which do tend, without a doubt, you know, remember, Dick, this from our state when we were at the commission, revenue recognition are the ones that tend to move things more so than other ones. Those became a much smaller piece of them post-SOX, and that could be impacting this significantly as well. And so I just suggest, as difficult as this is to do, and I do know it's extremely difficult, it's important that you be able to go in and dig in and look at all of those, and that's really what I'm hearing some of the academics say around here. The other piece of it, though, that is also of keen interest to me is, Steve, you and Marty indicated these are all what we'd all consider to be errors. So I'm assuming that is they just didn't comply with GAAP. I'd be interested in knowing and seeing in the paper if that's the case, because I think what got us into the problem that we did with the corporate scandals for the most part, even in big cases like Enron, you see where people start out initially with small errors that then got bigger and bigger and bigger. And by the time we got to then Chairman Leavitt's speech in September of 98, he talked about the culture of gamesmanship with these type of adjustments, where we were letting people get by with adjustments that we knew were wrong, that people weren't following GAAP, and yet we were giving them passes. And there's been companies like McDonald's and others that have been cited as prime examples of that. Waste Management was one of those. W.R. Grace was one of those. But we created that culture that said, it's fine, you can have errors, you can do the accounting wrong, but unless it's big enough, and in Waste Management, it even got up to 10 to 12%, and they said, yeah, it's quantitatively big, but it's qualitatively immaterial, and there we'll give a pass on it. And yet that created the culture that got us into trouble during the scandals, because as those became bigger, people went down the slippery road and then triggered us into these others. And I think you need to discuss in the paper that and the concept that we've had a behavioral change to where post-SOX, especially with the certifications, people, and I think correctly so, are much more of the mindset, let's go get it right, rather than passing. So you've got instances where people are correcting things now that pre-SOX they never would have corrected, and there's really no discussion of that whole thing in this paper at all. And it really doesn't address what I consider to be ultimately the real question here with all this research, and that is, do you want to go back to the culture of gamesmanship we had before we made that cultural change? And you need to answer, is that what you're advocating in this paper? And I think you should conclude and say, are you advocating that in this paper? Because there's some people, including, I believe, some people on the SEC Complexity Committee, that are saying, in essence, this is the evidence for supporting that type of going back to that culture.
I just have a brief comment. As I'm feeling pretty good about this now, because Jana and I are going to do the rest of our research from an undisclosed location. Well, you know, this is a very difficult area, and being economists, and I think maybe at a bit of a disadvantage of not being accountants that are researchers in accounting and so forth, is we really were just looking to see, is has something changed? And in fact, when we came up with this, our might be a $20 slide now, we're not sure, but when we came up with our slide, we recognized that something's going on here. And the thing that I've been advocating to folks at the PCOB is, look, we've started a discussion that I hope a whole bunch of researchers and other interested parties out there will latch onto, and they'll answer the questions for us. So it's never been our intention to be the experts or answer all the questions here, but I hope that people will take this and kind of launch forward with it. I think there's value in that. So.
Good. Joe Carzella?
Yeah, most of the points that I was going to make have already been made. There's just two other things you might want to at least think about, Steve, and maybe these aren't issues. But your sample combines two databases. It combines the Ming-Wu database from 2002 and then PCAOB's kind of own internal database. And one concern that I had is, unless both of those databases use the exact same approach in building the database, differences across periods could be due to different protocols and database construction. So if they are constructed in exactly the same way, you just need to say that in the paper. If they're not constructed in the same way, then you need to think through what the potential implications of that are. The other thing is, your initial sample is like 1,700 observations, and you exclude what you describe in the paper as non-overlapping restatement announcements, or you exclude overlapping, so you're left with a non-overlapping sample. which is 518. And you do this for statistical reasons. But one thing, there's always trade-offs in these choices, right? Because now what you have is you've lost two-thirds of the original sample. And so then a concern that I always have, and I know a lot of times academics get nervous when you exclude big chunks of the population, particularly if you exclude them for reasons other than the data doesn't exist, and that's not the reason you're excluding these, is your remaining sample essentially representative of the population from which it was drawn? And so you need to at least think about that.
Damon Silver?
I just wanted to urge you to pay particular attention to Ted White's comments. I thought that he embodied very, very clearly and precisely what I was trying to say somewhat vaguely earlier.
And I think the last card up was David Becker.
Just to the extent that you're looking at reasons for the change in the drift downward pre-announcement, I'd just point out that the SEC changed its 8K rule, requiring announcement earlier, in effect. And I just sort of anecdotally there, before that, often clients would want to do is not make multiple announcements. And until you know what the number is that needs to be restated, or you want to have as much information as possible before going to the market. But the 8K rule said, no, as soon as you know that you are going to have to restate, you got to disclose.
Well, thank you all for the comments. I think Steve and Jan have gotten some very good input here. As I said in my opening comments, Steve and Jan have acknowledged that their normal process would be to have gone through channels that somebody referenced earlier of seminars and publication for peer review, which they intend to do. We also wanted to get the input of this SAG, and we felt that when they published it, when they went through looking for peer review, the fact that it was a PCOB economist doing the study, it would get out regardless, and we thought it would at least get out in the sunshine via this fashion here today. So thank you very much for those comments.
Okay, we want to turn to the last agenda item today, which is emerging issues and wrap-up. Several SAG members suggested that we sort of do an updating, if you will, of our last emerging issue in June with regard to the subprime lending situation as well as the current liquidity situation in the market. And to sort of kick off that discussion, I'm going to turn it over to Mark Olson, who has a few remarks he'd like to make, and then Marty Bowman is going to also update us with regard to several matters.
Just very briefly, we talked a little bit about it. The issue was starting to emerge, although the signs had been around for a long time, but it's restarted to emerge at the last SAG. And in the intervening months, of course, it's become a major issue. And as Fed Chairman said, it's going to have a huge impact on the economy and a continuing impact on the economy for some period of time. Marty and his group have been giving us regular updates on some of the issues, and while there are a world of issues that we could spend enough time so that all of you would miss your flights, we thought it would be useful just as an educational opportunity and to just highlight some of the accounting and auditing implications that we've seen and that we've been following and keeping track of. So with that background, Marty, back to you.
All right, thanks very much, Mark. As Mark said, at the last SAG meeting, we did open up the floor for discussion about the subprime developments and reactions that SAG members had from a accounting or auditing perspective. Since that time, the subprime crisis has certainly led to a larger liquidity and credit contractions in the marketplace much more broadly, and really into the identification of significant risks in various investment vehicles that some may not have really understood were there before. And I think many of us have read terms in the paper and different types of structured investment vehicles that we hadn't really focused on or heard too much about in the past. From the PCAOB perspective, we have been actively discussing these risks throughout 2007 in our regular meetings of something we call the Audit Risk Working Group, which includes PCAOB representatives, senior technical partners from the audit firms that are inspected annually, and senior staff from the Center for Audit Quality. We've also participated in conversations with the accounting firms, SEC staff, FASB, and banking regulatory agencies regarding the accounting and auditing issues emanating from these current market conditions. Also, our inspections teams certainly have considered these risks in both their inspections of certain 2006 audits taking place during 2007 and in planning for the 2008 inspection cycle. As many of you are probably aware or might be aware, the accounting profession, through the CAQ, issued three white papers intended to interpret existing GAAP with respect to certain of the accounting issues highlighted by the current market conditions. The white papers dealt with measurements of fair value in illiquid or these less liquid markets, and there's a lot of discussion and controversy around that as to how much the extent to which thin trading should be taken account of in valuing financial instruments. And so the discussions that took place earlier about fair value were very, very pertinent during this most recent quarter, and a white paper dealt with the subject of how to deal with information in the marketplace in getting those fair values. Another white paper dealt with the consolidation of commercial paper conduits. And again, a very challenging area dealing with FIN 46R, which was the accounting standard that came out to deal with really special purpose entities in the post-Enron environment. I think it's still fair to say that dealing with the consolidation of these of entities that aren't really owned by anybody and is still a very complicated issue, and the white paper addressed possible reconsideration that might have to take place of consolidation of these conduits when market conditions change. And then there was a third white paper on accounting for underwriting and loan commitments. A very large number of loan commitments were made in connection with a lot of the private equity deals, et cetera. Some numbers in the neighborhood of $360 billion of commitments that had to be funded in the third and fourth quarters are numbers that I had heard about, and the white paper dealt with how those commitments should be accounted for. In many cases, the values of those commitments had deteriorated. So again, while the current market conditions create significant uncertainty for investors and lenders, they've also surfaced some extremely complex accounting issues that preparers and auditors have had to deal with during 2007 and during the third quarter. So overall at PCAOB, we're closely monitoring these current market conditions, which create an environment certainly of elevated accounting risk, and we'll issue additional audit guidance if we believe it's needed. So with that introduction, I wanted to open up the floor to receive input from SAG members on your perspectives on this credit and liquidity crisis and any observations you might have for us. And I'll start with Cynthia Richland.
Actually, this is a question for Tom. Has FASB got any plans to take a look at 46R and think about revising it? It's kind of surprising to investors, you know, after the Enron debacle that we would again have off-balance sheet, non-transparent, non-disclosed entities of this magnitude.
At this point, we don't have any plans to revisit 46R. We've been looking at the issue just recently to try to understand whether or not non-consolidation was the appropriate accounting, giving accounting standards for the conduits. I think we consider that there are significant issues with the backups that's explicit and implicit that were in the sponsoring banking organizations that might suggest consolidation may have been needed and didn't occur. So if that's the case and we confirm that significantly, then it isn't one of a 46R problem. It is more one of application of 46R.
Lynn Turner.
I commend you, Marty, for staying on top of this and working, because I think, as Mark mentioned, this is a big issue, and this is going to be with us for a while, and perhaps it could grow even bigger. You mentioned you met with the CAQ and the Big Four and all. Have you met at all with the credit rating agencies to get some flavor for what they're seeing and what they're concerned about, as well as whether or not they feel they're getting all the disclosure and information? Obviously, they got the right by contract to get certain data if they're the rating agency that's getting paid. But I'd encourage you to meet with the credit rating agencies just to see what they think they need that they aren't already getting. And clearly they're on record in the public, in some public venues, as saying they felt like they were getting all the information they should have been getting, and that impacted the quality of their credit ratings. So it would be, I think, worthwhile to go pursue that and find out what it was that they weren't getting that they needed. The SIV thing that Linsmeyer just mentioned, my experience in looking at some of these was when you really drilled down into the documents, there were usually trapdoors or triggers built into them that would cause you concern about whether or not they should be consolidated. And we would find those, and it almost seemed like as if the audit partner had never dug down into those and didn't realize that they were there. And so I think it's very much so worthwhile pursuing those and whether or not those needed to be consolidated. Also, and a question for Zoe, right after FIN, or as FIN 46 and then FIN 46R evolved. I know there was a lot of consulting with the SEC and OCA on these. Did OCA take any positions with respect to consolidation of these SIVs that may be now coming back to have an impact on what's going on? I certainly think it would be worthwhile turning around and taking a look at that. And the last thing is, I met yesterday morning with an analyst who has pulled the filings of several dozen of these great big ones, and he's gone through the footnotes and disclosure, and he found the FIN 46 disclosure in about half the filings, and in half the filings, there was no such disclosure. So it does look like a number of these filings have been able to get through and get by the audit and review without complying fully with FIN 46. And if that's the case, I'd certainly encourage you, especially in light of what we're hearing about from the rating agencies about not having enough data, I'd certainly ask that you look at that, and if that's what we find to be the case, you know, why and how is it on something that's having such a major impact on this economy? Can we sit there and allow those financials to go out with a clean bill of health?
Thank you for those comments and that insight, Lynn.
Lynn, just a quick follow-up question. Were those the filings of the investment vehicles or the sponsors?
The sponsors.
The sponsors, thank you.
So the filings, the companies like Citigroup and whoever had sponsored the CIVs.
Damon Silvers.
There's been some discussion, less in auditing and accounting circles and more in other places, about sort of in the who's to blame category that has focused on the question of the behavior of holders of this paper in different types of financial institutions. And I wondered if in the board's work so far, just any differences in terms of foreign private issuers versus U.S. institutions around the accounting treatment of asset-backed paper.
We really can't, I don't think, talk about any of our inspections processes, as I think you're aware. It's fair to say that, as I said, our inspections are taking note of these issues that I addressed, both with respect to 2006 audits that they're inspecting now and are planning for the 2008 cycle.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And I guess hearing no more comments on that, I guess we'll bring this meeting to a close. Once again, it's been very productive. I really want to thank all of you for your active participation and your advice. Unless we call a special meeting between now and the end of the year, this will have been the last SAG meeting of this year. And some of you, of course, will not be joining us next year. Because your terms will have expired. I know some of you have been nominated for another term, and the board will be announcing the new SAG members by the end of this month, so stay tuned. I do want to especially thank those members who have just completed a term, and for those of you who won't be returning, please stay in touch, and if you have any advice for us, please don't hesitate to reach out and let us know. Thank you, and the meeting's adjourned.